So I'm recording myself so that people who are not here can get access to, hopefully, if the battery holds, to the course. So today we're doing an introduction to human-computer interaction. So this course, Fundamentals of HCI, the goal is to give you an overview of the field of HCI, and especially from the perspective of research in that field. This is a research master, so we're trying to give you an idea not only of the practice of creating interactive systems, but also the type of research that is conducted right now and that will make it hopefully into products in a few years. So these are the eight classes I will be teaching. So today's introduction. This week we're doing the first three classes: introduction, graphical interaction, the type of interaction you know the most and you use every day. And the third would be on engineering of interactive systems. How do you build interactive systems? And the reason for doing this is because next week and the week after in the TAs, you will be programming interfaces. So it's good to have an overview of how you build interactive systems. Then the five other classes cover the experimental approach. How, when we do research, do we test our results? Pointing and navigation. These are two very simple tasks that you find in any interactive systems. You spend your time pointing on your screens, whether it's your finger on your smartphone or with a mouse on the screen. And it seems very simple, and in fact, understanding how pointing works is an interesting research subject. And same thing for navigation, when you browse the web or when you navigate a Google map or something like this, you do navigation, and these are basic tasks you find in every interactive system. So we'll look at them both from the theory side and also from a perspective of how, you know, techniques can make us point better and navigate better than we do on today's systems. And this theoretical aspect will be developed even more in the next class, Theories and Models of Interaction. Well, we'll look at a large collection of theories and models, some borrowed from other sciences, in particular psychology, some from computer science, and some from human-computer interaction itself. Then we'll talk about conceptual design. How do we design interactive systems? And that will sort of be a link to the class that Anastasia presented briefly this morning on design of interactive systems, which is one of the electives. And finally, the last class will give you a summary of the elective we are not doing this year on what's called groupware and cooperative systems, so systems that help people work together. Okay, so first, what is human-computer interaction? I'm sure you have heard, I'm not sure you've heard the term human-computer interaction. People often talk about user interfaces, or in French, interface, utilisateur. On parle beaucoup d'interface, mais pas beaucoup d'interaction. Same thing in English, people often talk of user interfaces, and the interface for this is good or is not good. And often they don't speak about interaction. So human-computer interaction is really about studying this phenomenon here. If I look at it from a scientific perspective, in science, in physics, or in biology, you observe phenomena, and you try to explain them. You try to explain them to show, you know, your understanding. Usually the next stage is you try to predict. So in physics, we have, you know, laws that allow us to predict that if I drop this pen, it's going to take this much time to hit the floor. That's prediction, based on observation that allowed us to first describe what happens and then understand it. And here, we have something similar. If you consider that what is in the computer is something that is given to you. So if I give you a user interface running on here, I can observe how people use it, and I maybe can make prediction of how many errors they make, how much time they take to do a particular task. So a lot of what I will be talking about will be in the perspective of studying interaction to understand and to predict. And there is a third level, which is what we call generative design. From understanding things, predicting them, how can I make them better? Now, this is not something you get to do in physics. You know, I cannot change the laws of physics to say, oh, I want this to fall faster, right? I can go to another planet, maybe, but I don't get to change the rules of physics. Here, we get to change the world, the thing that's running on the computer. So if I have a system that I observe or predict to make a lot of errors or to make people unhappy, which I'm sure you have run into, right? Can I use this understanding to make the system better? And that's the whole issue of design of interactive systems. So we'll get back to this, of course, in more depth. Now, just to have you participate a bit, because I don't want to be the only one talking for 3 hours. Do you have examples of systems that you have found frustrating? Or worse?
Windows.
Windows, okay, Windows, but we'll do Microsoft bashing time and again, but be more precise.
I don't know, maybe the network part in Windows is very frustrating.
So configuring the network?
Yes.
Okay. Okay, another example?
MS-DOS.
Sorry?
MS-DOS.
MS-DOS, okay. Who uses MS-DOS anymore? So why was MS-DOS frustrating?
You have to know all the commands by heart.
Okay.
It's not very interactive.
Okay, so it's a line-oriented interface. So you need to memorize, and that's something we'll get back to. It's recognition versus recall. Recall, I need to remember. Recognition is I see a menu, I say, oh, this is what I'm looking for. And in psychology, recognition is always easier than recall. But it has its problem too, so.
I had the same problem with Linux, because you have to know the commands in order to give an open a folder or anything.
Okay. So. But Linux also has visual interfaces, so you're not always in the command line, right? Okay. One more, in the back.
Yeah, I don't like Facebook interface. I think it's like there are a lot of picture information everywhere popping. If you want to get something precise, you don't know how to get it. You have to click on every windows, every little list. So yeah, I don't really like it.
Okay.
Too much information.
And you think it's done on purpose, or you think they should?
I think yeah, it might be done on purpose because like that's their job. I mean, Facebook is just an interface, so I don't know why they're doing that. But yeah.
Well, sometimes they want to, I don't know, a lot of companies make money by selling advertising.
Yeah.
So they want to
you
to click everywhere to click the advertising. So
maybe.
That could be the, I don't know, I am not on Facebook. I am on no social network. I already have a hard time dealing with my email. So. Okay, so... So what will be interesting as an exercise as we go on is to try to understand beyond this notion that, you know, I don't like this interface, why is command line bad and is it always bad, or, you know, why is it hard to configure a network, or why is an interface like Facebook too busy, to try to understand if there are some deeper principles behind that that we can then apply to fix these things. The other thing I want to point out on this first slide here is that what we're trying to do when we create interactive systems is to make two entities communicate that are really very different from each other. I know it seems silly to say this, but the capabilities of computers are about computation, so crunching numbers, storing large quantities of information, and input and output, although they are not very good at that. In fact, if you look at the progression of the computation capabilities and the storage capabilities, they have grown a lot faster than input and output. the display you use today is pretty much, well, it's color when 20 years ago it was black and white, and it's a little bit bigger. But in the meantime, computation and storage have gone up by, you know, thousands of times. So we have this thing that is very good at certain things. And then in front of it, we have a user who is very good at other things. We're good at perception, perceiving the world. I can instantly tell that there are 2, 4, 6, 7 people in the room, that we are in a classroom. So I can perceive a lot of things that are very hard to perceive by the computer. We are good at physical action in the world. We're good at language as a way also to act in the world. Other things that a computer is not so good at, and we are also very good at cognition. And the cognitive things, memory, planning, problem solving, are things that we try to emulate a lot in the computer, but not very well so far. Did any of you see the game where the Jeopardy game, where the IBM computer won against humans?
Yes.
Yes? So who knows about this? Okay, can you explain briefly what is Jeopardy?
Jeopardy is a TV show. I think that the question is not really a question, it's an answer to a question, and the participant has to find the question to which the answer is given. So IBM has programmed an AI, and who beat all the human participants in the program.
Right.
So it was very difficult because the goal of the game is to find the question. So it's not like the question is given and then you find the answer. You have to find the question to which the answer is given. So that's more difficult than the other way around.
Okay. So I saw the game and it was very interesting because when the computer was right, it was of course very quick. But for some tasks where you're given an answer, you need to find the question for which it's the answer, it was completely wrong. So when it was wrong, it was completely wrong. Because on TV they would show you the current thinking of the computer in real time. And the other thing is that it's also a game where reaction time is important. The first person who hits the button gets to answer. So oftentimes the humans had the answer, but a fraction of a second later. And in fact, there's something that I think was a bit unfair in that the computer could not respond too early. But the humans, if they hit the button before the sentence is fully displayed, they are penalized. So you don't want to answer too early, and I don't think the computer had this problem. But it is a very impressive system in that it has a lot of everyday knowledge about facts from, you know, TV shows to history to lots of things. So it is fairly impressive. But still, when you think of it, it's a very narrow task, and this huge computer was optimized for this one game. So I think, and you know, people think that maybe one day artificial intelligence will really beat human intelligence. But I think this is the wrong way to put things. I think what is interesting is that we have two entities here who have different capabilities, and what is interesting is to use one to improve the other and vice versa. So the way I think of interactive systems is how can computers make us smarter? Or can we make computers smarter? But not with the goal that one day the user will be redundant and we can get rid of it and the computer will do everything. I beyond being somewhat scary, to me it is just not interesting. I think what is interesting is how can we make these two things cooperate, work together to solve things that neither a human alone or groups of humans alone or computers alone are able to do? And there are problems like this today. In fact, there are very seemingly simple problems for which humans are still better at computer than computers. for example, optimizing the routes of a fleet of trucks. So if you are, Federal Express or La Poste in France, you have trucks that have to go deliver goods, right? Now, if you take one truck, the computer knows to optimize this very quickly, even though it is an NP-complete problem, so, you know, there's no easy way to do it. But for one truck, you can do that. Now, if you have a fleet of 100 of trucks, it turns out that it works better if you let humans, if you let the computer start, propose a solution, and the humans look at this solution and say, no, no, you can do better here. This looks good, don't touch it. Try more here. And they have run experiments where the results of human plus computers is better than humans alone or computers alone. And there are other examples like this in this type of optimization tasks in particular. So I think this is one example, but another example that we will see later on visualization. When you try to find something, but you don't know what you're looking for. So you don't have a way to tell the computer, look for something interesting. You are the one who can judge what is interesting. But the computer can put the data in a format that it makes it easier for you to find what is interesting to you. So there are many places where we are really interested in this collaboration between humans and computers. Now, the thing is that the real world is a little bit more complicated. It's rarely one user in front of one computer doing one thing at a time. Today, we all have multiple devices and things that we use. And most of the things we do are not individual tasks, but are group tasks. So we need to collaborate with, coordinate and collaborate with other humans. This happens in a physical environment that also raises some constraints, whether I'm trying to do something at my desk or in the train coming here or in the plane, will change things. And the world is not just people and computers, there's also real-world artifacts, physical objects that we deal with. And we spend a lot of time, if you think of it, this thing here, starting in the computer, I'm putting it into paper, into physical form, to give it to you. You write notes on it, and maybe you will scan them to get them back into the computer. So we spend a lot of time juggling between the real world and the electronic world. So this is what we call situated interaction, in that interaction does not happen in the void, it happens in the context. And this context affects the things we can do, we cannot do, and how efficient we are. And of course we need to create systems that will take all of this into account. Many systems today are designed to only work in one kind of environment and then don't scale. So do you have examples where something you do is complicated because you have to communicate with others or because you have to operate in different environments?
Maybe a big project like video games or programs. Programmers just have a small part and have to work with other parts and put them together, and it's really difficult.
Okay. But what about something you do? I mean, I know when you do projects and you work two or three people on a project, how do you communicate and exchange what you do and all that? Is it?
That's really hard.
Right.
Everyone has its own program, his own plans, his own ideas, so it's very hard to combine all of them in order to reach a certain goal.
Okay. So that's a coordination task among humans. Yes. And one thing I always run into is people use different programs, so different editors, and just exchanging the files gets complicated. Like, I have a file and I've touched one part and you have a copy and I don't know which copy you have, and we spend a lot of time coordinating. Maybe you haven't been involved in these kind of things, but just last week we were writing research articles, and each article had between two and six authors. And we spend a lot of time to make sure that I'm not changing something that the other is changing at the same time. And the tools we have, well, there are some tools that help, but it's really not part of the computer we use, which was designed as a personal computer for one person to do one thing at a time. And when we try to do collaborative stuff, it's harder. Now, we can use Google Docs, and things are starting to happen, but to use Google Docs, I need to be connected to Google. And when I'm in the plane, I'm not. So it doesn't work everywhere. So this is just, you know, a few simple examples where this notion of situated interaction is really important to understand that systems are going to be used by users we don't think would be using them, and in environments and contexts we didn't think they would be used for. And that happens all the time. So let me try to give some definitions here. I think you all have a background as computer scientists, except one student this morning from CCE. I don't know if he's here. So when I talk about interactive systems, I talk about the thing that is running in the computer. Right? And I prefer interactive system to user interface, because the user interface is a part of the interactive systems. But to me, when I build, say, Facebook, it has a user interface. Okay, it's, you know, web interface. But there's a lot of things going on in the back for it to happen that was designed for that interface. So the whole thing is the interactive system. And so an interactive system is a computer system that holds an internal state. Usually there's a database somewhere, or there's something. And what it does is that it creates perceivable representations of part of this state. So again, with the Facebook example, you know, when you log in into your Facebook account, you see part of what's in the database, the part that the system is supposed to show you. So creating representations is an important point here, where we are going to go from abstract data to things that make sense to human users who are not computer scientists. Don't imagine that you are a representative user of interactive systems, right? You are geeks. We are geeks. I'm a geek, right? We are in computer science because we like computers, and so we understand how they work, and we are like a mechanic owning a car. You know, if something goes wrong, I'm happy to go in and go in the engine and fix things. Most people are not like that, right? So a lot of problems go on just in this state of in this stage of going from the internal state, what is inside the system, into what do I show users and what will make sense to them. And what you were mentioning about setting the network configuration on a Windows machine, it's because people don't understand networks, right? What is an IP address? What is a mask? What is a whatever? People doesn't make sense to them because they shouldn't have to deal with it. So that's part of the reason. The second thing that is important here is that it's what I call, and I'm not the only one to call it, a non-algorithmic system. What I mean by that is what you learn in computer science is to write a program that that starts by reading some input. I read a list of numbers, then I crunch a sorting algorithm, and then I output the list of numbers sorted. That is an algorithm. It takes input, then does something, it's a black box, and then a result comes out. An interactive system takes input in all the time, and the input comes from you. Every time I type, I click, I hit, I speak to the system, it has to take the input at this moment. If I were to click on the system and nothing happened, we would be frustrated. So an interactive system has to react to input as it arrives into the system. And that makes things very different than what you have been used to program, I assume. I'm sure some of you have programmed with, I don't know, maybe Java Swing or some toolkits, or have done some HTML. So indirectly you have dealt with that. But the fact that in Java or if you program for the web, you have things that are called event handlers or event listeners or things like this, it is because of that. It is because it has to handle that input when it arrives. It cannot wait until all input in there, then shut down input, compute, and then spit the output. So on the website, on the wiki for the course, there is a pointer to this paper by Peter Wagner, Interaction is More Powerful Than Algorithms, which is, to me, an extremely interesting piece because it shows that with interaction, you can do more than with just algorithms. And the reason for this is because as you make the system interactive, you can use capabilities of the outside world. Because your output is going to be consumed by the user, processed, and then the future input from the user will be affected by what the system has output before. So you are in a loop. And so it takes the example of a very simple machine that can be very good at chess just by being a relay for a human chess champion. So it's a simple example and pretty useless example, but in theory, it shows that interaction can, the word he uses is harness, take advantage of capabilities that are outside the system, which regular algorithms cannot do. So I strongly encourage you to read that article. The last thing that is, in a sense, a consequence of that is that an interactive system is an open system where the system outputs will affect future input to the system, but in a way that is completely unpredictable by the system. Not completely, but largely unpredictable. Because if I take two computers that talk to each other through a networking protocol, you know, the protocol is fixed, and usually it's very strict. So, you know, I send you hello, you send me your number, and then I can start sending you a message, and then I expect an acknowledgement and things like this. So network protocols make machines communicate with each other, but in a way that is very strict and very predictable. And if you receive something that is not part of the protocol, you ignore it or you get into an error or something. When you're talking to the user, you have to expect that the user is going to do everything, anything. Just put a kid in front of the computer and you'll have a good way of breaking a lot of systems. So this notion of human in the loop, which is not a term I like really, because it makes the focus more on the computer, but this notion that you have loops with humans means that you cannot build dependency into the systems. So it is an open system because I have to create a system without knowing exactly what input it will send me, and so I have to be prepared to receive any type of input and not crash. So this was the more I would say computer side of the approach. Here is more what the user side is like. And it's what I call the conceptual model. So the conceptual model is a model of how the system works. And if you are going to use any technology, not just a computer, but a washing machine or a microwave oven or whatever, or a car, you need to have in your head a model of how it works. Now, for most computer systems, this is pretty much how it works. So here you have commands. The user is going to create commands for the system. There are many ways to create commands. I can type in the command line interface under MS-DOS or the Unix terminal. I can use clicks and you know, look into menus and make commands this way. I can also use speech if my system understands speech. So there are many ways to enter commands. Entering these commands takes some time, so the system needs to give some feedback to the user, so even though the system is not trying to understand these commands yet, it's telling the user that, you know, it's getting the input. when you tap the keyboard to enter a line, if the characters don't appear, it would look wrong, right? So this is very simple feedback. But same thing when you take an icon and move it across the screen, the icon follows your cursor, and you know something is happening. When the command is over, then this gets turned into what I call an operation. So here, this is, if you wish, the user interface, what really the user sees, and this is more what's going on inside. And so these commands are turned into internal operations. Delete that file, or fetch this data from the database. And these operations operate on internal objects. And then these operations will give you a response that will be turned into something the user can understand. So something will change on the screen, and the user will realize that what he was trying to do has worked, or maybe hasn't. Right? So you can look at all the systems you use with this grid here. You can identify the commands. There are easy and line-oriented interfaces because a command is a line. When you use a click and drag interfaces, it's a bit more complicated to see where a command starts and stops. But you can see that, for example, if I bring the print command, the print will bring me a dialog box where I enter the number of copies and things like this. And it's really when I click OK that the command is formed. So a command can be a fairly long sequence of actions in the graphical user interface. And then you can start looking at what is the feedback that is provided, what are the underlying operations, what are the underlying objects, and what kind of responses I get. So what we will see later on in the course is how this conceptual model can be used to improve the design of user interfaces. And I'm sure you're all thinking, well, I sort of knew all that. There's nothing really mind-boggling here. And one danger is that because we are all users of interactive systems, we all use computers all the time, we all get frustrated by, we say, oh, why did they do it this way? And, I would fix it by doing it that way instead. So we are all not only users, but in a sense designers, in a sense that we know how to fix it. And there's much more to design than trying to fix something that irritates us. Sometimes it is a real problem. Sometimes it's a real problem for you, but not for other people. And so if you are designing a product for a million people, so how do you make everybody happy? And for example, one thing that I think separates Apple products from a lot of others is that Apple's nose to make choices. And some choices make some of their users unhappy, but they're willing to pay the price. But others will often create more options. So their way of making the product more attractive to more people is to make options, to make you, in a sense, the designer by checking the right options. And so designing is not about giving all the options to everyone. Designing is deciding what I can take out without making the thing completely useless. So being a designer is really different from being a user, even if I have a lot of good ideas about how to fix this and that. And research in HCI is yet another thing where we're not only interested in making better products. We are interested in research in understanding some fundamental aspects that can then be used by designers, but many researchers are very poor designers as well. It's completely different roles. And the thing is that the paradox of human-computer interaction is that if I make a really good interface, nobody will notice it. That is true. And if you try to think of things that you've never realized that there was really an interface because it works so well. You notice problems, you don't notice when things go well. So for a designer or researcher, it's frustrating because when you succeed, nobody will tell you, oh, that's great. The only measure is that nobody complains. So, and the reason for that, in turn, is we as humans are extremely adaptable. We adapt to everything. And that's, of course, a strength. That's probably why we have survived and are where we are today. But it's also a weakness, because it means that a lot of users can adapt to a poor interface to the point where they're not willing to make the effort to get to something that would make them more productive. And there are many examples of that. One example that is often cited is the keyboard. If you look at the layout of the keys on the keyboard, it is weird. Who came up with that? Right? So do you know how it happened?
It's the typewriter, so that the slate would not
jam.
Yes.
Right. So all typewriters were mechanical. So when you hit a key, there would be a thing coming. And if you would hit two keys next to each other, these two hammers would jam into each other. So while the first one would come back, it would hit the second one, and they would get stuck in the middle. Have you ever used a note? No, I guess you're not from this generation, right? I will add on the website, I found recently an article about the history of typewriters that is extraordinary. Because there was a whole history before they had keyboards with one key per character. But anyway, if we start there, so someone said, okay, this is a problem. So what I'm going to do is to make sure that characters that are often next to each other in English text or French text will not be on keys that are next to each other on the keyboard. So for example, you know, in French you have le ou la are very frequent. L-E, L-A, and so I don't want the L be next to the E or the A. And so the keyboard was engineered to slow you down by making things that are often together in text far away on the keyboard. Another part of the story is that to help market the keyboards, they make it so that the letters typewriter, the word typewriter, all the letters are in the top row. So the people who were selling these things didn't have to know how to touch type. They could demonstrate the product by typing typewriter with one finger on the top row. So the net result is that it was designed to make it slower rather than faster. And in fact, we know of other layouts of the keys that would make you about 10% faster. So one that is well known is called the Dvorak keyboard. But who today will want to relearn to type with a different layout? And even if you were willing to, where would you find a keyboard with a different layout? So you would have to put stickers. It just doesn't work. Now, one other aspect of this story that is often omitted is that when I said they were slowing down, that was for people who were typing with one finger. And in fact, it was a long time before people figured out they could type with several fingers. And what was then slowing you down because you had to go back and forth a lot, when you type with two fingers, in fact, you find that oftentimes the successive letters are alternating hands, left, right, which then allows you again to regain some speed. And this is where it is. The reason why I think we are stuck with this layout is because an improvement of 10% is not enough to change people's habit. If someone had come up with a layout that was twice as fast or three times as fast, probably people would have changed. But 10%, it's not good enough. So people have adapted to this, they're happy with it, and 10% is not enough to trigger a change in behavior. So this ability to adapt to things that are not optimal is very strong with humans, and oftentimes makes it more difficult to have innovations that actually have a success. Okay? So, two summary lines here. HCI is a complex multidisciplinary domain. Multidisciplinary because we have to know about computers, we have to know about humans, we have to know about creating systems, about sometimes organizational environment, how people work together in an environment, how and so it's really multidisciplinary in the sense that you need and I'll have other slides about this in a moment. And design and research require unique skills, and they're all different. Being a user is not being a designer, is not being a researcher. And, you know, there's nothing wrong with not being any of these things, but they are very different. So what we're not trying to do when we do research in human-computer interaction, we're not trying to just develop or design interactive systems. We do develop and design interactive systems for the needs of research, but not in terms of products we try to sell. But what we try to do is understanding interaction as a natural phenomenon. That was my first slide. Invent what we called interaction techniques, so more like the building blocks of the full interface. In the course on pointing and navigation, I'll show that there are maybe 50 different types of menus, for example, that and some can be three times as fast for you than others. But then it's the designer's work, someone else's work, to take these menus and then put them into a real system. We're also interested in creating tools for developing interactive systems. Today, the way you program interfaces is really bad. Really. I mean, it takes a lot of effort to do something that is not usually very good, and it's very expensive to change. And then we also look at methods for the design of interactive systems. So again, we're not designers, but we're trying to give designers tools to improve the process. And so one of the methods that we will spend time on in the class, again, that Anastasia presented, is this notion of participatory design. What we try to do is to involve users in the design process, not just asking them, what is your problem? not just asking them, do you like this? But really involving them at every step. And the reason for this is because we don't know how to put the users into equations, right? So it's only through a trial and error that we can improve systems. So here's when I was talking about multidisciplinary approach, the kind of things that are relevant to building interactive systems. And so they are organized around three poles here: natural sciences, engineering, and design. So in natural sciences, we build on knowledge from psychology, the psychology of humans. You know, memory, cognition, perception, action, all of this is the domain of psychology. It includes some physiology also. And then when we go to looking at how groups of humans behave together, we go to sociology and anthropology. And in fact, some methods from anthropology in particular are used to help people, like I'm sure they do it at Facebook and Twitter and others, to look sort of how people use this system to better understand what their needs are. So these are all the natural sciences, and you will find in both research labs and sometimes in industry, anthropologists, sociologists, and certainly psychologists to work in these groups to create systems. Then there is the whole work of design, and that's interesting because it's outside the scope of what we see in many universities, especially in France. So design is about architecture and topography and visual design and industrial design and product design. All of the things where essentially the knowledge is not captured into theories or models or laws, but into accumulated knowledge about architecture or topography, for example, or good examples. And, you know, one thing that was a key success to the first Macintosh was the fact that Steve Jobs dropped out of university and attended classes in typography and discovered the world of typography. And years later, when he designed the Macintosh, he said, I want to have good typography on this machine. At the time, nobody was doing anything else but fixed size fonts, right? Like, and so he was the first one to get real typography into a computer. And then everybody, of course, followed and said, well, we have to do at least as good as that. But to learn typography, you cannot learn that in books. You know, you have to... You have to really take years of classes to understand about everything about fonts, and it's the same for these other things. And they are really important to building good computer interfaces. A lot of things that look cluttered, meaning there is too much stuff on the screen, is because they didn't have a good visual designer to make it better organized and easier to read. That's oftentimes as simple as that. And then, of course, there's all the engineering part with computer engineering, electrical engineering, mechanical engineering, optics, and others. And a lot of things we see really recently is user interfaces that use a lot more than just the computer interface in terms of the keyboard and the mouse. So using... cameras, for example, to do vision-based interfaces. One thing that people are very excited these days is the Kinect. You know, the Microsoft Kinect. So it turns out, the Kinect is a system you can buy to plug on your Xbox, I believe, for games, and it detects gestures that you do in front of the system. But it turns out that you can actually take that and plug it in onto a computer instead of the Xbox and program with it. So you can get access to the 3D data that it extracts. And so a lot of people have started using this to make gesture-based interfaces, for example. And so a lot of research in human-computer interaction these days really uses a lot of things from other disciplines like electrical, mechanical, engineering, vision, and others. And so, you know, if you are to work in creating interactive systems, you have to know that you cannot know everything. And a good group will have a little bit of all these disciplines represented really put together great systems. And now again, having showed this, which was more in the context of the general process of creating interactive systems, I want again to focus more on research. Because when you look at the way people conduct research, it changes from discipline to discipline. If you are in natural sciences, here I take the example of psychology, but it also applies to physics. Oftentimes, you want to test theories. So you have a theory of something. Usually, this theory comes from looking at the real world. But you start with this theory, and you want to test it. So to test it, you design an evaluation here in the form of an experiment, for example. And then usually the experiment don't give you exactly the results you were expecting, or sometimes not at all. And from there, you update your model, or you create a completely different model. So you go from theory to the real world, back to the theory, and then back to the real world. In other sciences, I take the example of anthropology here, you also have this back and forth. Oftentimes here it starts more in the real world. And in anthropology, it's about a lot of observations. And then from all these observations, you try to create what they call, not a theory, but usually it's called a framework. And from this framework, then they realize that they need to do more in-depth study of some things in the real world. The point is that in both cases, you are dealing with theory, real world, abstraction, reality. And you go back and forth to try to have abstractions that explain the real world, maybe help you predict it. In human-computer interaction, but it's the same in computer science in general, there is another thing, which is that we create artifacts. We don't deal with the reality that is already out there. We create artifacts that extend this reality. And our theories, models, abstractions, whatever you call them, are about those artifacts. So what I will do oftentimes is start with observation. I observe, for example, that people don't have, you know, they have a need to communicate, and the tools I use today are not sufficient. And then I have a theory that social networking, for example, which is not something new. Everybody thinks that social media and social networking is new, but I mean, it's been written about by anthropologists and by sociologists for years and years. But I use this theory of social networks based on the fact that each individual has a network of friends, colleagues, and that communication happens through these networks to create an artifact, and I call it Facebook. Now, of course, I'm rewriting the history here because we know this is not really how it happened, but I'm illustrating this with that example. So I create an artifact and I put it to the test, meaning I have real users using it. And then I realize that they are going to use it in a way that I hadn't anticipated. And so because of this observation, I have to revise my model, and then I create a new version that takes into account those findings and changes some things or adds new features. And then again, I put it through the test of the real world. I observe how it's used, and then I revise my model abstractions theories, and I create a new model. Okay? And that's what you see all the time when people make new versions of things. Or rather, this is what should happen. Because oftentimes, unfortunately, in product design, what you find is an arrow from this to there to there without going neither to the abstraction part nor to the real world. You listen to people from marketing who tell you, oh, we need this feature. Users are asking for this. And then you create it and you don't ask any questions. And usually that's what makes poor products. If you are really serious about designing systems, you have to do this kind of constant zigzag between the world of abstractions, the real world, and the things you are building to make it better. Does this make any sense? Yep. So, I'm even on time. Incredible. So, let's get back a little bit to this notion of the design of interactive systems. As I just said, when you create a new system, you have to be aware of what we call human factors. And the problem with human factors, which, you know, use knowledge from psychology, sociology, is that we know a lot, but it's not like physics. It is not, in terms of quantitative theories, much less equations. So we know a lot about human memory, we know a lot about human problem solving, we know a lot about human perception. But not in a way that is generative, as I explained before. So from this knowledge, you need to really make a lot of trial and error to see what works and what doesn't. But it is really important to build on that, and too often we forget about that because we are humans, so we think we know ourselves, and so we think we don't need to test this or that. But oftentimes we are ill-informed if we just look at ourselves. The second aspect is that when you design something, you create a new system, and it works or doesn't, but it's not always obvious why. And one reason for this is what I call the chaotic aspect of design. You may, at some point, when you've created a system, make a very small decision at some point, or maybe not even realizing you were choosing to do it one way or the other. And then it turns out that this decision has great consequences on whether the system is usable or not. So, example? One example that took close to 30 years to fix, well, 20 years, is the 1 pixel line in Microsoft Windows. I told you we were going to do some Microsoft bashing, so here it goes. So for a long time in Microsoft Windows, you could open a window, maximize a window, making it full screen, right? And in fact, I often see a lot of people who only use their Windows full screen on Microsoft Windows. If you look at the display for the Macintosh, you probably know, maybe not, but on the Macintosh, the menu bar is at the top of the screen, right? So there is a current application, and the menu bar for that application, instead of being inside the window for the application, like on Microsoft Windows, it is at the top of the screen. On Microsoft Windows, if I maximize a window, the menu bar that is inside the window, of course, gets to the top of the screen. So when I have a maximized window on Windows, I have a similar situation as the Macintosh. Now let's see what happens when you try to select a command in that menu. So if I'm here, so of course what you need is to go at the top here and to click to get the menu. Now what happens is, here if I go and I hit the top border, I click and my menu is still there. We'll see later on that there is, in fact, one of the very few laws that have an equation in psychology is called Fitts' law, and it lets me predict the time it takes to point. And what I can tell you is that because I can, in fact, hit the top of the screen here, the size of what we call the target, what I'm trying to point to, is this size. It's the width of the menu. It's not the height. The height doesn't matter because I can bump into the top. So all I'm aiming for is the word format. Now, if I were on Windows, it turns out that until Windows 7, I believe, if you maximize the window, there was still a 1 pixel border around it. So you couldn't, if you clicked at the top, you wouldn't click the menu, you would click the border. And therefore, to reach that target, what counts is not the width, but the height, which is much smaller. And if you measure, and you can do this, and people have done this, so you don't even have to do it, you just look at the papers, it takes 3 times as much to click in the menu on Windows than on the Mac. So a very small decision, someone somewhere decided to leave a 1 pixel border. That is really useless, because when you click the border, nothing happens anyway, right? And that costs 2 seconds to every user every time they click a menu. So that's what I call a small decision and a fairly large consequence in terms of time that is lost, that people, of course, don't realize, because if they use Windows, they think that's the way it is anyway, and that, you know, they don't realize they're losing time. But now, I'm sure if you try to think, you can find other examples where something that is time-consuming or creates a lot of errors may be traced to also a small design decision. In fact, this one is interesting because someone from Apple actually made an experiment with his colleagues at Apple. It turns out on the Mac, if I plug in an external display, I can tell the system where it is relative to the main display. And so what he did is that he plugged a display in one of his colleagues' computer, but he hid the display away, and he told the computer that the display was above his display. So when he was throwing the cursor to hit the menu bar, instead the cursor would continue on the second screen. And of course the person would lose the cursor and didn't understand what was happening. But what he measured is that the cursor regularly ended up in the middle of the next screen. So people were really using this ceiling effect. And because it's there, they were using it, they were learning to use it in a sense. So these are the kind of thing that, you know, it's very easy to make the mistake, and it's normal to make the mistake. The question is, how do you then have the idea of testing for it and solving it? And so I think that's really the point I want to make here. It's not just the, you know, for the purpose of criticizing Microsoft. To me, the problem is more that they took 20 years to fix it. That is a problem, not that the problem was there in the first time. And so because of this, and because it's so hard to predict things, we need an iterative approach. We need to try and try again. And so the general process is here. It's an analysis by observing users, designing, trying things, prototyping, creating prototypes or revisions of existing systems, evaluate them with users, and from that, revise our analysis, create new designs, and try again. And a good process will do this dozens of times before they let the product out. And the researcher will iterate dozens of times before they are happy with the new technique, as I talked about before. A researcher will more likely be testing with controlled experiments. In product design, you often don't have the time to do it, so you do lighter evaluations, but it's still very important. And you won't find any designers who gets it the first time. What makes people good at this is the willingness to try, throw away, try again, improve, throw away, try, etc., until you get it right. There's no other way. If there were, or if you find one, then you can get the Nobel Prize in HCI. But I doubt you can get it, because things evolve also over time. And you know, users evolve, and as they get more proficient in using computers, the things you create for them also evolve. Okay, and the last slide for this introduction is what I call interaction paradigms. And to me, the world is divided into three categories. There are people who consider that the computer is a tool. It's just like a hammer or a screwdriver. It helps me, it augments my capabilities to do things I couldn't do without a computer. So a text editor is a very sophisticated screwdriver. I call this computer as tool. I call this first-person interfaces, because the user is really using the tool. And the goal is to augment the user capabilities. And because this is my religion, this is what I will teach in that course. Other courses in the master's will look at other things, so don't worry about that. But this is my paradigm, or the one I pick. Another one that is equally valid and very widespread as well is the computer as partner, where I talk about second-person interfaces in the sense that I try to delegate tasks. So this is more the computer that is built by people who believe, since we're using this metaphor, in artificial intelligence, where I have a computer that has human-like capabilities, like understanding speech or natural language, like we saw this morning the virtual humans, so having the computer presenting itself through human-like figures, and therefore the computer is the partner, the human partner. And as I said, to me it's equally valid. It's just that I happen to be more at ease with the first. And in fact, what I think is that in the long run, these two approaches should be merged. Because sometimes I want a tool, and sometimes I want a partner. Sometimes if I fix my car, I want to go see a mechanic who can fix it for me. And sometimes I can fix it myself. Another example, if I go to a bookstore, sometimes I know exactly the book I want, I know where to find it in that bookstore, so I go there, I pick the book, and I'm done. Sometimes I don't know what I'm looking for, or it's a book that was talked about on TV, I can't exactly remember, so I need to talk to the librarian to, you know, give me advice or find the book for me. So I think, you know, these two things are useful in different contexts. It turns out that currently these correspond to very separate types of systems and separate types of people who work on these projects. There is a third one that, really in the past couple of years, has literally exploded with the social media stuff, but that was there all along. This is the notion of computer as media. The computer is a way to communicate with other people. So I call them third-person interfaces, because I'm the first person, the computer is the second, and so I'm talking to the third person there at the other end. And it's really what we call mediated communication, or human communication. And of course, with Facebook and Twitter and all these social networking tools, it's very widespread today. But we'll see in a minute in the history that it was there at the very beginning of the history of human-computer interaction. So this is the part that will not be covered in this year, since we're not doing the elective on groupware and computer-supported cooperative work, but I'll do the last class of this course about this, just to give you an idea of what's there. Okay, do you have examples of things that you would put in the first, second, or third category? So where do you put Google?
As partner.
Yeah?
Yeah.
Yes, no? Why?
Want information about a thing, for example, but you don't really know what you want, so you only have keywords, you search, and Google gives you more examples, and then you choose what you really want to know.
Okay. Do you agree?
I put it in the first line, the first category, because it helps you, and basically we don't need Google, you can search
Well, how would you do that?
With another app.
Well, when I say Google, I'm talking search engine in general.
But it's basically just a big help. We can have a big list and look at everything. It's wrong. But
okay. Well, but that would be a tool. I'm thinking with her. I think Google, at least the way they try to engineer their systems, is really to be more a partner in that it is using a lot of knowledge it has about you and about how people in general search to give you a list of what most people want when they do this type of query. No, but I agree that it's not necessarily all, you know, fully decided.
In the same time, it's a tool to help you. you know nothing, for example, about any information, and by using this tool, Google, it helps you.
Right.
So maybe we belong to the first one.
So I think people sometimes use Google in the as a tool.
It's, for example, they type Google in the Google search list and then go to Google. I don't know. Or they type Facebook and then click on the Facebook link instead of typing facebook.com.
Exactly. I mean, I know that there are many sites that I get through Google because I know that if I type this, the site comes first, and it's a shortcut. So I use it as a tool. And sometimes I use it as a partner when I don't know exactly what I'm looking for, and you know I'm doing variations of the request to see what comes up and things like this. So,
for example, if you search what human-computer interaction means, you have the most accepted opinions, the most accepted articles. That's why I say it as a partner.
Yeah.
But in the meantime, yes, if you want to search Yahoo, I don't know,
yeah,
a website, yes, it can be a tool.
Okay.
It's a good dictionary tool.
And calculator, and so many other things. So another tool you use regularly, something else.
Microsoft Office.
Okay, so Office. Word.
What do we use?
No. Say, Office is Word plus Excel plus PowerPoint. So let's pick one. So Microsoft Word is that.
It's a tool because it doesn't do anything alone. You have to type what you want to type,
right.
And also the layout, you have to do it yourself.
Okay.
So, yes, it's a tool.
Okay. You agree?
But you have the spell check.
Yeah?
So it's kind of a partner. It's like helping you to find your mistake and stuff like that. You can also synchronize with people, regression. I don't know. It's more like... when you work like within a team, like it's kind of the kind of thing that you have to agree with the others. Will we use the Microsoft Word or not, etc.? Because it's more than just a tool.
Well, but once you've made the decision, I think.
Yeah.
The first thing you were saying about the spell checker, I think in Office in general and Word in particular, they try to put some aspects that are more the computer as partner. For example, sometimes it tells you, oh, I think you're writing a letter. Can I help you write a letter? I mean, I usually go and disable all these options. But the famous Clippy, you know, that was trying to give you advice was really trying to do the partner thing. But I think basically it is a tool, and they try to put in some of the things that work to be more human in helping you to do common tasks. And I don't think it works. Okay. So I think maybe we should take a short break. But really short, because we still have quite a bit of things to do. And so let's get back in, let's say 17 after in my watch. So I would like to start at 25. So it's 8 minutes.